Next week, phase one of the plan to reopen Jacksonville and Florida will begin. JEA's board fires its interim CEO, and the Florida Bar investigates a suspicious local election that wasn't even an election. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. Hope you're doing all right out there. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week and our Friday Media Roundtable. You can join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, how about this? It's a new way to cope with all of this pandemic stress. We'll show you how to take a sound bath. Yeah, a sound bath. Keep listening for that. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hey, Ann.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have you with us. Our regular contributor and board member Charles Griggs is also on the line. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. And here in studio with me, WJCT's own Sky LeBron.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Sky. And lots to talk about this week. Most of it, of course, related to the pandemic. First, this hour, we want to give you the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 33,690 cases and 1,268 deaths. Here in Northeast Florida, we are standing at 1,675 reported cases of coronavirus and 43 deaths. And after weeks of lockdown, both Jacksonville and the state of Florida will start phase one of reopening plans on Monday. Governor DeSantis and Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry both outlined these plans earlier in the week. And here's what we're going to be looking at. Starting Monday, restaurants and retail stores in Jacksonville can reopen at 25% capacity. The reopenings must follow Center for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines for social distancing. You're expected to wear masks. Gyms, movie theaters, and personal service businesses like hair salons and barbers will remain closed. And if you can work from home, you're expected to keep doing that. Let us know what you think about this reopening of the state on Monday, a partial reopening. Give us a call with your thoughts, concerns, questions. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open as well. Ann Schindler, let's begin with you. We've seen quite an intense debate about whether this is a good idea for Florida and for Jacksonville. On the one hand, businesses are suffering terribly. People are out of work. They've got to find a way to start earning money again. On the other hand, public health experts are warning us that the virus is still with us and that we might be through the first wave of it, but that there are likely more to come. What are you hearing from people around town when we look at this reopening, phase one reopening next week?
Well, Melissa, it's hard to overestimate the economic hurt that people are experiencing right now. It really is profound. And so many people are desperate to just get their lives back from an economic standpoint. You know, the problem is we won't know for weeks or months how impactful this decision was from a health standpoint. And when you're looking at decisions that go into reopening, you know, the economy is one of them, but the people who are in the business sector are advocating for a return. The people in the health sector are not, and that's important. I mean, those are not the people that are saying, let's get back to normalcy. They're saying, stop, put the brakes on it. You know, this is going to be a regrettable decision. And both of those things could be true. I mean, like I said, you can't underestimate the economic hurt that people are experiencing. They've watched their lives go from relatively stable to rocky, unpredictable, and really, in some cases, financially desperate. So it's a balancing act. I think that everybody is trying to find a way back to a place where at least the economy is moving in the right direction instead of cratering. But as I said, it's going to be weeks or months before we know what the impact of this decision was from a health standpoint.
That's right. Charles Griggs, the mayor and the governor both are basing this reopening on data that shows the curve of new infections and serious cases in hospitals is flattening. They still say they have a number of ICU beds available. Our hospital systems aren't being overwhelmed. And so they're hopeful that with social distancing and other common sense measures, they can keep the rate of new infections down. And Ann is absolutely right in that the economic pain across the state and the country is severe. We hear from business owners all the time having to make terrible decisions about trying to get a loan, a PPP loan, laying off staff, trying to figure out if they can keep paying their rent. At the same time, you know, when you talk to restaurant owners, they're not sure how they're going to handle this phase one reopening, taking in 25% capacity of customers or perhaps at a retail store, the same thing. There's a lot of uncertainty out there right now.
It is, Melissa. And also, there's plenty of room for ambiguity in the way that these reopening plans are being applied. If you look at the fact that gyms, movie theaters, personal service businesses like hair salons and barbers still need to stay closed, but you're giving restaurants the opportunity to kind of figure things out on a, you know, the 25% capacity, there's plenty of room for things to get very confusing very fast. But what it does politically, it allows for the government to say that, listen, we recognize that we need to give you space in order to be able to make money or to move the economy. But at the same time, we still want to leave some restrictions in place. Melissa, this is no different than any other public health approach to any other disease or outbreak. You have to weigh the danger of the community versus how much the community is willing to accept in terms of a response. And what we're seeing politically is that, you know, slightly ahead of the danger of the community is how much we need to for the economy to stay on track versus taking into consideration how safe people are in the community. Because what we're seeing is that even though we have, you know, cases have been, you know, sort of going down, the trend isn't long enough for us to feel like people are really, really safe. So providing space for folks for the businesses to get back in the game is just a small measure, sort of a small carrot for those people who are really kind of clamoring at getting back out there.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Charles Griggs, Ann Schindler, Sky LeBron, and yours truly, and you. What do you think about the reopening of Florida and Jacksonville next week? Phase one reopening, it's being called. Do you feel comfortable going back into stores and restaurants? How will you be handling this? Are you a business owner? What's your plan to reopen? We'll go to your calls in a moment. It's 549-2937. Sky LeBron, beaches in the area have been open for a while. St. John's County also says it's going to now allow people to sunbathe and picnic on the beach. Nassau County is opening its beaches, and so that's another area that we're seeing of people trying to resume some state of normalcy. Shopping malls like the St. John's Town Center and the Avenues can open Monday at 25% capacity. You've been looking into this as well, and what are you hearing from folks?
With the beaches, I would say it's been pretty split. The opinion is starting to lean a little bit more. From what I've seen, that, you know, people want to go back out to the beaches. I think in particular, Nassau is an interesting case to look at because a week ago, they were initially saying that May 6th was their tentative date for opening the beaches for social distancing and not allowing people to just sit on the beach. Pretty much the things that Duval and St. John's was doing. And then I think they got a lot of pressure from the community to open up a lot sooner. And now we're seeing it open up today, May 1st. And they're allowing people to sit on the beach. The main things that they're not allowing are things like driving on the beach and horseback riding on the beach. So, So things that, you know, are much less than maybe just social distancing and sitting and having a picnic, things like that.
549-2937. Let's go to some of your calls. Let us know your thoughts about Florida starting to reopen for business next week. Cody is on the south side. Hey, Cody, good morning. Go ahead.
Hey there, good morning. So I would just like to kind of play devil's advocate a little bit with the reopening. From the very beginning, I was very for a total shutdown. And I still kind of am, but I've been leaning towards reopening. Right now, we have the entire medical system focused on this problem, okay? And we're kind of under-equipped. My father's in the hospital. He needs heart surgery, and he can't get it for a few days because the hospitals are shut down. This tells me, one, we don't have enough resources to get the emergency treatments that we need. And two, that next time this happens, we're going to be underprepared again. So we need to take systematic steps at medical universities to find a way to get a surplus of doctors, to get more nurses, because we need to be ready for this.
Sure.
We're a service industry. We need to be focused on the important things.
And Cody, what's your are you working right now?
I'm not. I day trade. I do investing.
Okay. So you're okay financially then?
You know, I'm surviving.
Well, that's good. Aren't we all? Well, thank you for your thoughts, Cody. You know, and elective surgeries in hospitals, people haven't been able to get those in this crisis, as he pointed out. That is expected to at least partially resume next week, too.
Yeah, that's been a kind of an interesting consequence of all the attention on the COVID-19 is that, you know, when the elective surgeries rolled back, hospitals started losing a really major source of income. And so what you're seeing is they have all these frontline people that need to be working in very dangerous conditions, and yet they're hemorrhaging money, you know, and it's a financial thing for hospitals and healthcare systems as well. And it's interesting that he's saying his father's heart surgery is being delayed because, of course, one of the other fallouts of this is they've seen people apparently, you know, declining to get treatment for very serious illnesses, chest pains, broken bones, because people are worried about going into a hospital setting because of contagion. So, but yeah, getting hospitals back in a place where they can safely do elective surgeries is really important to the healthcare system, because without that financial stream, they are more peril of being able to provide healthcare for COVID-19.
Yeah, Charles, I mean, we've heard that a lot. People are deathly afraid to go into the hospital right now. They just don't want to be there. And they are not doing what they would normally do if they were very sick. They're avoiding the hospital. And that's also affecting public health.
Yeah, and they're also avoiding the hospitals because they don't want to clog up the healthcare system for people who may need it, need to utilize it at this particular point in time. And, you know, there's also, Melissa, something else to consider as we look at, you know, how the city and cities across the state reopen. You know, many of the rules that that apply for the general public don't really apply to the government system. You know, for example, the city council, they're still meeting remotely. They're still going to be meeting remotely throughout the month. You know, when in fact they probably could hold some committee meetings in person, you know, under the rules that have been outlined for social distancing. And, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I've heard people say to me, well, if it's not good enough for them, it's not good enough for me. And I'll feel more comfortable, you know, getting back into the public life when I see, you know, some real practices being put in place by people who are actually governing the city.
Right. Andrew emails the show and says, the problem with the reopening is it will take several weeks to determine if it's successful. I worry that our impatience will not wait that long, nor will people abide another shutdown if there's a resurgence of infections. Lisa tweets the show, we've been going to grocery stores and they've adapted. Stores will need to take strict precautions as to how many people they'll allow in. But will that actually happen, she says. Kathy tweets us, I'd like to better understand why hair salons can't reopen. My stylist has 4 chairs. There's rarely more than 8 people in this space. If everyone wears a mask, how dangerous will it be to get a haircut? Deborah tweets us, restaurants at 25% capacity, but you're expected to wear a mask? How do you eat with a mask on? That's a good question, Deborah. Jason tweets us, isn't the reopening really about the failure of state government's inability to distribute unemployment insurance and the federal government in its ability to help small businesses? Sky, you know, we've seen that across this state, the failure of Florida to get unemployment benefits to people who need them.
Yeah, and two-fifths of people that filed for unemployment were already rejected, and then they were being told to reapply. I think that's something that the state is going to have to answer over the next couple weeks and provide some avenues, because that website has not been good. They shut it down last weekend, and they reopened it, and people are still having some struggles with it. So I think over the next couple weeks, this is going to be a huge topic, because some people, as they're returning to work, they're in flux right now.
Yeah. You know, Ann Schindler, to try to at least help a little bit with this, the city of Jacksonville is going to begin handing out prepaid $1,000 debit cards on Monday to eligible citizens. It's a one-time payment of $1,000 for mortgage, rent, and utility bills. Annual household income must not exceed $75,000, and you have to show that you have a reduced income right now. So many questions from people about this. This is a huge, huge concern for thousands and thousands of Duval County residents out there. I know you've been looking into this over at First Coast News as well. People have a lot of questions about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see this morning. You know, it's in half an hour, I believe, that the city's website opens up and starts vetting people, applicants for that money. The mayor himself said he expected it would fill up pretty quickly. I can't imagine we'll have more than an hour of that website being up before the 40,000 initial applications are taken. So, and of course, those people still have to be vetted, so they may reopen it if there's some people that are applying that aren't actually eligible under the guidelines, which, again, is, you've got to have lost 25% of your income, essentially, since the start of the COVID crisis. But, yeah, the unemployment, as Sky mentions, that unemployment system has been such a colossal failure. And, you know, I think what has been eye-opening for people on both sides of the aisle is how deliberate it seems to be. You know, lawmakers are saying this system was designed to be difficult to navigate. It was designed to dissuade people from seeking unemployment benefits, or at least from seeking them over a long period of time. And so the problems that people are running into, by and large, are, you know, crafted into this system. And I think it's been eye-opening for the governor as well. You know, he initially was reserved about assigning blame, saying, you know, let's focus on going forward, fixing the problem. But now he's calling it a clunker and a jalopy that he inherited from the Scott administration. And I haven't yet to see our Senator Rick Scott really answer for the system that he implemented.
That's absolutely right. Let's go to a few more calls. 549-2937. Don on the north side. Hello, Don. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, the point that I wanted to make was the original narrative was we got to flatten the curve because we didn't want to overwhelm the healthcare system. And it looks like we did a great job doing that. You know, there are beds available, et cetera. So that's fantastic. It seems like things have shifted recently to now, hey, we can't reopen until we're safe. Not, you know, that we're going to stress out the healthcare system, which obviously it could happen if there's a significant resurgence. But it seems like now we've moved to saying, hey, it's got to be safe before we can reopen. And so now the question is, well, who decides safe? That's a very vague criteria.
Thank you, Don. And Charles Griggs, yeah, people do have a beef, I guess, with this partial reopening in terms of what's open, what's not, how this will be executed. Rebecca emails us and says, I don't understand the logic behind restaurants opening at 25% capacity, but salons can't do the same. Isn't the risk equal? You know, I guess a lot of difficult decisions went into how to roll this out, but it's not going to please everyone. Okay, looks like we might have lost Charles.
Melissa,
go ahead,
Ann. I was just going to toss in there that, you know,
hello?
I think that's a good observation because it's not any longer, you know, initially it was about flattening the curve. It appears we've done that. And the reality now is that, and I think all of the health experts have basically said this, it's not a question of reducing the net number of fatalities from this disease. It's about extending that over the long haul so that our hospitals aren't overwhelmed. And that is what's driving this decision to reopen, is the fact that health that the health system has managed in this area to maintain, you know, availability and vacancies so that there's room. They haven't had to use the emergency hospitals that they had, you know, the field hospital that they'd gotten going. So, that is true. The curve appears to have flattened, and that was the goal.
Yeah, and Charles, of course, all the social distancing, all the closures, that's what kept the curve flat. And as you pointed out, if we have another big spike in cases and we have to shut down again, how are people going to handle that?
Yeah, we don't really know. Again, I think one of the callers pointed out, we don't really know what the spike really looks like. It's going to take some time. Plus, you know, all of the experts know that there's a lag in how the information is reported. By the time we get to the dashboard where people are making decisions, that information is fairly old. So we won't know, what type of impact this type of reopening is going to have on the public. Many experts believe that, public health experts believe that what we consider to be flattening of the curve is really sort of a point where we've accepted or we are able to work with a certain amount of cases, a certain amount of risk for the community. And that's what we've entered into. We've sort of, because we've been successful at social distancing and putting in some of these measures, we've sort of been able to accept this number of cases within our community. How that impacts us over the long term, before there's a vaccine, before there's treatment, we won't know. But until then, the practice of social distancing is really all we have to keep the public safe. Now, many people feel uncomfortable going back into communities or in areas where that were meant to be crowded facilities, like restaurants, for example. And they're going to continue to question whether or not this applies to them or their family members.
It's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories from the week with Charles Griggs, Ann Schindler, Sky LeBron, and yours truly. Here is an email from Mike. Business needs to reopen. Our economy cannot take much more of this. Anyone that's currently working at home should continue that. But when it comes to entertainment, I won't be one of the ones who goes out and gets sick going to a beach. Sky LeBron, you know, the beaches are open. Restaurants and stores will reopen. The big question business owners have is, will the public come in even at 25% capacity?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see. I think it's going to be a huge thing to look at over the next week. I mean, I think a lot of people also want to go to their favorite restaurant,
yeah,
want to go to their favorite store. So is it going to be hard for these retail stores and for these restaurants to keep people out? The other thing that you and I were discussing and thinking about potentially is for some of these restaurants to keep it at 25% capacity, is it worth staying open at 25%? Are they still able to make a profit that they can justify at this point?
Jane is in Ponte Vedra. Hey, Jane, happy Friday. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, my question is how really we can move forward without a plan for the W effect, where we have spikes in the virus, it goes down, and then it goes back up. People without a strategic or tactical plan, every day is going to be kind of guesswork unless we do strategic planning and track people with antibodies as well as the disease. We're all going to have to be tested a couple times for the disease and that antibody testing.
Yeah.
So how do we move forward to protect ourselves and still open with this W spike effect that could be coming?
Sure. Dave is tweeting us about that too. He says we need the testing and tracing infrastructure in place to do containment. If we don't have that, it's right back to mitigation. Ann Schindler, you know, Jacksonville is actually testing a lot more aggressively than some cities. There are several sites around town where people can get a test. That said, it's still only a fraction of the population, and we have no contact tracing mechanism really in place, either locally or anywhere around the country, as other countries implemented right away when this pandemic hit. Testing and tracing has been an abysmal failure in this country, and there's really no other way to put it. And the inadequacy of that has led to all of these other economic woes that everyone is experiencing right now.
Yeah, I think that the W effect that the former caller was mentioning, I mean, that is going to happen. I think we're going to see a series of kind of increases and decreases of the curve again. You know, before the shutdown, or is part of the momentum for the shutdown, was we can't reopen until we have contact tracing that's reliable, until we have testing, wide-scale testing. You know, before we... I think at one point the mayor said when we go back to work, he would want it to be in a circumstance where employers were giving tests before people came back, or at least taking temperatures of people before they came into the building. I haven't heard quite those strictures in place for Monday's planned reopening. But, you know, I think because there just isn't the testing capacity in place, that desire slash requirement has been abandoned somewhat. It's not a requirement that I'm hearing anything at the federal or state level in terms of, you know, testing before we return to work or some sense of normalcy.
Yeah. Charles, I mean, I know so many people that would love to have an antibody test performed. They are curious to find out if they have developed antibodies to the virus. These are people that have had symptoms and people that haven't, because you can have antibodies and be completely asymptomatic. And they're thinking, well, if I have antibodies, I could be cleared to return to work. I might not be passing it on to anyone else. But we just don't have that in a widespread way yet.
We don't. It's one of the many deficiencies around this response. You know, testing, tracing, treatment and isolation are the way you mitigate these public health outbreaks. And as far as the antibody tracing is concerned, testing is concerned, even if someone has antibodies, the jury's still out on how long they would be immune. So they may be, you know, they may have immunities for 2 weeks, 2 months, you know, who knows? So there's a lot of questions still around that science. But what we haven't done here, what hasn't been done early on, is really to build confidence in our ability to trace the people who've been tested and who've been confirmed, and give us a true sense of, you know, how we can build a wall around or up against the spread of the disease. And unfortunately, you know, the day before yesterday marked 2 months since we reported our first official case in the country.
It's been 2 months. And, wow. Yes, I've lost all track of time.
Yeah.
And, it feels like a year.
But ironically, we reached 60,000 cases, you know, pretty much on that day. 60,000 deaths, I should mention, on that day. And you know, even though the rate of infection may be slowing down, we don't know if the rate of death is going to slow down. And again, once people reach an acceptable amount, this will be like business as usual, which is what we're seeing with, you know, with a lot of the requests to get back to business, because people are fearful that the economy is going to suffer more than it already has, and they're trying to weigh that against their risk of becoming infected and eventually maybe potentially putting themselves at risk of dying.
Sky LeBron, we have 43 reported deaths from COVID in Northeast Florida. That's almost certainly an undercount. There are likely more that aren't in the official count, but that said, you're seeing a different approach in Jacksonville than, say, South Florida on reopening. There are so many more cases down there that you'll see a lot more closures continuing in South Florida than you will up here. Both the governor and the mayor have said there are regional differences around the state and that we need to take that into account when we look at getting back to business. People that have noted, we have less than 50 official deaths here, as tragic as that is. We haven't been a hot spot for coronavirus necessarily, and they're pointing to that as a rationale for trying to reopen business.
Yeah, growing up in South Florida, I'd always heard that South Florida is a different state than the rest of the state.
Yeah.
And now it's really being treated like that, with Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade being treated. They're not going to be a part of phase one just yet. It'll be interesting to see how long it takes for South Florida to catch up with the rest of the state. But yeah, even yesterday, when Mayor Curry was talking about his part of reopening, one thing that he did bring up is potentially tailoring Jacksonville to a different some different rules than phase one. He said in short order he would consider even making some changes to phase one to see how, as Jacksonville has really flattened the curve, how maybe they can get a couple more things opened on the side.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, as you said, this all gets underway Monday, and in less than half an hour, people can go online and apply for those $1,000 prepaid stimulus cards, which will go quickly. Let's get that information on the air again, if we could. I know that people continue to have so many questions about that. They need to go onto COJ.net to begin, correct?
Yeah, they have to. They have to have some paperwork at the ready. They need to be able to certify that they lost 25% of their income. They have to make less than $75,000 annually. So this applies to a lot of couples. For instance, if there's somebody that has entirely, fallen out of work in a two-paycheck household, that kind of thing. And then they have to be a resident of Duval County, of course. And all of that information will be then collected in person when they have an appointment. Those will be assigned out. They'll begin Monday at downtown at the Ed Ball Building. People will have to actually go physically present the information. And then they'll leave, if they're approved, they'll leave with $1,000 on a card, not in cash, but they'll leave with the money in hand if they're approved. And part of the goal is to make this very, smooth and free of a lot of paperwork and hassle. They really want to get the money out there to the community as much as a jolt for the local economy as for the individuals in need.
Sure. Let's take one more call on the COVID pandemic, and then we'll move on and talk about some other stories from the week. Tommy in Jacksonville. Hi, Tommy. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. Hope you're doing well.
I am. I just really wanted to make a quick comment about, I feel like our leaders are really running almost unchecked. I know the state of emergency gives them a certain amount of power, but last time I checked, we're still a democracy, and This kind of just seems like we're getting all of this kind of top-heavy rules about opening up the economy. We are a democracy, not a capitalist. Capitalist is a economic policy, not a ruling policy. And I feel like the merchants and all of these folks are not taking the greater good in consideration when we're making these decisions. Yes, long as Wall Street is open, the economy is not shut down.
Do you think then that the lockdown measures need to keep going? Or do you disagree with
it? Absolutely, the greater good. Look at South Florida. South Florida is really still, my wife is from Broward.
Mm-hmm.
She's a nurse here in Jacksonville, and her mother's a nurse down in Broward, and they're getting their butts whipped. So last time I checked, there's no border to stop my family from coming up from the south to Jacksonville because they've been on lockdown. So let's say they want to go and eat at Applebee's.
I hear you, Tommy. And I thank you, Tommy. Thank you. Thank you for that. Charles Griggs, healthcare workers have sacrificed enormously in this crisis. And when you talk to them, they'll say they don't agree with the reopening. They almost see it as a slap in the face to the risk they're taking and the work they're doing.
Absolutely, Melissa, and that's because they're going by information that they have firsthand. They see people continue to get sick, and they understand that the risks that are being what the community has to weigh. And again, what you have to look at, what the policymakers are looking at, is that they're hearing cries and from the people who are insistent on the economy continuing to move forward without catastrophic damage. And they believe that if they, walk a thin line towards saying, hey, everything's open, but you just got to do this, that gives people the freedom to be able to continue to do the things that they believe that they should be able to do. Unfortunately, under the conditions of a pandemic, that's not always safe. And so we're going to find out here very shortly whether or not these policies work for the good of the community or the good of a few who are more concerned with the economy than with lives.
That's a great way to put it. And we're going to move on now on our Friday Media Roundtable and talk about some other important news from the week, including JEA. Yes, they're back in the news. JEA's new board of directors this week fired the utility's interim CEO, Melissa Dykes. This was a surprise move. They said it was symbolic, but that they really felt it was important to show the community that JEA is turning the page on its scandals. Former JEA CEO Paul McElroy may be the favored inside track candidate to step in and lead the utility once again on an interim basis, not a permanent one. All of this as there's a federal grand jury subpoena right now demanding records from JEA over its aborted attempt to sell itself off to a private company. Ann Schindler, this was not, it's really not that unexpected that the board would do this, given that there's such pressure on them to show that they're moving forward to a more transparent, more honorable way of governing.
Yeah, I think that they're interested in sending that message. At the same time, this really was a surprise. I mean, I was watching, I think, the first two-thirds of that meeting, and I had to buck out, and that was, you know, seemed very pro forma, the stuff that they were talking about. And then I started seeing the tweets and kind of leapt back on. I was taken aback, not so much that the idea of firing Melissa Dykes. What really surprised me is that a board that is meeting for the first time unanimously votes to oust the CEO. It's not an agenda item. And there's already been discussions about McElroy taking over. To me, that doesn't send a great message about transparency. To me, that sends a message about how did everybody get on the same page? I didn't see anybody talk about that too much. It troubled me just by the optics. I don't understand how a brand new board that has never had conversations about the CEO and firing her with or without cause and sending her with a $160,000 packing is something that just comes up at the last quarter of a public meeting.
Sky LeBron.
Yeah, and I think that Ann bringing that up is really interesting. She's totally right. That was not, it wasn't clear on the agenda that that was something that they were going to be talking about and something that was going to be so, it's going to be decided right then and there. A lot of the board members were saying was, you know, we feel like Melissa Dykes has done a great job in her interim role, but we have to send a message to JEA customers and JEA employees that we are doing things differently. And people aren't going to think it's just more of the same. I thought that was a really interesting thing about it. And I do think that it was somewhat planned because at the end, Melissa Dykes was able to give her CEO report and she read off of a paper. And in the end of that statement, she was still reading off of a paper when she was saying, I was complying with the feds and everybody else that was involved in this investigation. So I think she knew coming in that this might be her last...
her swan song.
Yeah, exactly.
She does walk away with more than $160,000 in termination pay. If JEA had sold off, she could have stood to make more than $2 million, Charles. Of course, this controversial scheme that former CEO Aaron Zahn cooked up where the top executives were going to make a lot of money in the sale of JEA is part of the federal investigation. The U.S. Attorney's Office is sending out subpoenas. They also want all encrypted communications between the mayor's office and the utility leadership. So there may still be indictments, shoes yet to drop in this investigation.
Yeah, much like Ann and Skylar there, you know, this cordial and planned send-off was unanticipated by a lot of the public. It does smell like people were, you know, kind of talking about this behind the scenes. There had to be some discussions. Melissa Dykes, she did state at the very last sentence in her report said she wanted to thank the chairman for giving her the opportunity to give her last CEO report. And that was, like Skylar mentioned, that was typed into the report. So there had to be some discussions prior to. And yeah, you're right, Melissa. The only thing people are really interested in coming out of JEA right now are the current investigations and the subpoenas from the grand jury, FBI, and so forth. So many folks are going to be keeping their eyes on how that moves forward. The board, it looks like, they're, you know, trying to be business as usual by continuing their search for a new CEO. But I think the curious other part is how Paul McElroy found his way back into the picture. You know, many people thought that that he was, you know, one of the casualties of this initial plan to sell off the utility. And now he finds himself back in the position where he may become the interim CEO.
It reminds me of that old saying in politics. I think it's a Chinese saying, if you wait by the river long enough, the bodies of your enemies will float by. Okay, speaking of bad optics, I want to make another note from the week. The Florida Bar has opened an investigation into circumstances around a very interesting judicial election. Fourth Circuit Judge Tyree Boyer withdrew his candidacy for re-election on the final day of qualifying. Right away, attorney Michael Khalil filed as a candidate for his seat on the bench unopposed. And the timing of this is what has triggered suspicion. Now, Khalil, in a statement, says there was no impropriety whatsoever. However, the Florida Bar is looking at this. Attorneys Ann Schindler, many of them across the city, have gone on the record saying this smells like a rat, which is unusual to do in criticizing a judge.
Yeah, extremely unusual. I mean, even criticizing another lawyer is almost just not done in this town. It's a matter of honor and sort of historical precedent. But yeah, this is a weird one. And, you know, part of it is because really nobody challenges sitting judges. So to have somebody file to challenge Boyer, Judge Boyer, would have been extraordinary. They just don't do that. Again, it's sort of this unspoken rule. So the idea that somebody would run and that Judge Boyer wouldn't have advance word about that challenge would be unusual. I think the other thing that really bothers people is you have a very capable judicial candidate in attorney Rhonda Peoples-Waters. She has run before. She has sought appointment before. This in a district where there, I believe, is one female black justice out of 55. And she had met previously with Boyer and the chief judge and said, look, I don't want to challenge a sitting judge, but I really do want to run for this position, and was assured that it was filled, that the judge was not going to step down, that he was going to seek re-election, and so she didn't file to run. And so her concern, and she's been, I think, diplomatic but vocal about it, is this was a missed opportunity for her and really for a city to have a fair representation in a very diverse city on its judicial bench.
Yeah, the local NAACP issued a blistering statement about this too, saying it appears to be improper. The Florida Bar will investigate for up to 60 days. We'll see what comes out of that. In the meantime, I want to thank all of you so much for your participation on this show. With us today, Charles Griggs, Ann Schindler, and Sky LeBron. Thank you so much, guys, for joining us, and have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Up next, how sound bath therapy can help you de-stress during these stressful times. Yes, we're going to take a sound bath after this. You're going to love it. This is First Coast Connect. Back in a moment.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Public broadcasting is a key source for public safety information, and our firm is pleased to address public safety issues on WJCT.
Learn more at waynehogan.law. Celebrating 45 years supporting youth in urgent need, the Youth Crisis Center now is building House of Hope, safe housing for LGBTQ youth needing physical, emotional, and mental health care in the growing local homeless community. More at youthcrisiscenter.org.
During these uncertain times, it feels like the news never stops, right? And NPR and this public radio station are always there, ready to respond and inform as the global pandemic continues to unfold. Even as so much in the world changes, we are still here for you because you have been here for us. We can't do it without you. On Giving Tuesday now, give so we can all keep listening. Here's how.
Text the word GIVE 899 to 44321 and thank you.
Staying at home means staying away from other people, and that lack of social interaction, it has real consequences.
Our bodies react to the loss of that interaction the way we react to hunger. It's physically painful, it's even dangerous long term.
I'm Elsa Chang, how to fight loneliness in a pandemic, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The UK fears it is now on track to record the world's second highest pandemic death toll. Here, the president makes it clear who he still blames.
We are not happy with China. We are not happy with that whole situation.
And Kim Jong-un keeps the world guessing. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, would you be interested in an effective and proven and non-invasive treatment that would reduce your stress and also heal the body and mind and spirit? I am. It's called sound therapy, and it's something so many of us could use right now. Now, typically to get a sound bath, as it's called, you go to a sound bath studio and you let these incredible vibrational sounds just wash over you. We can't do that yet because of social distancing, but you can really get a sound bath virtually right now, too. I spoke about it with Diana Manzano of Sound Bath Jax, and she shared these healing sounds with us. Take a listen. Diana, good to talk to you.
Hi, I'm doing great. How are you?
We are hanging in here, and I'm so curious to hear more about how sound baths work, because we're all looking for ways to reduce stress and anxiety. And taking a sound bath is a medically proven way to do that. So first, let me ask you, what is a sound bath?
So a sound bath is basically where you're actually laying down, perfectly comfortable, mat, whatever you need to be comfortable. And I play the crystal singing bowls, I play Tibetan bowls, I play a gong. And the purpose of it sounding as a bath is because the waves of resonance that come from the vibrations of the bowl actually act as a bath over you in order to bring you peace and relaxation and a little zen.
It is a really zen experience for people that have done it. They rave about it. Doesn't it slow down your brain waves, slow down your heart rate? Doesn't it have an actual physical impact
physical
on your
effect.
Body?
100%. So the vibrations actually act as a brain scrambler, to be laden terms, in order for your brain to actually quiet itself, to heal itself. So when your brain is able to get down into those lower relaxation levels, like right before you fall asleep, as you're totally zenned out, your body actually begins to relax, begins to slow down, and therefore your breathing slows down. When your breathing slows down, basically your heart rate goes down. And so, yeah, absolutely. It has a physiological change to your body. In order for the body to then heal itself, to when you're not stressed, your body can take care of itself.
Which is what we all want. Now, in this current time when people can't come see you and get their sound bath, they can do it virtually, right?
Absolutely. So I'm offering some Instagram Lives, Facebook Lives. I've partnered with a couple of local Jacksonville Moms bloggers, who one of them, and we've done lots of them. I mean, in this moment, we all have so much stress, and it comes in different ways, and it's not exactly the same. You don't feel the vibration quite as intensely as you would in person, but absolutely, you still have the benefits of just quieting the mind, even if it's 30 or 40 minutes, just to get a little bit of peace in this craziness right now.
We're going to give people a short taste of what a sound bath is like when you visit Diana or connect virtually. So let's listen right now.
I feel better already, Diana.
Good. That's the whole point.
And I can't wait to come see you in person and get my sound bath.
Absolutely.
Now, you have a Facebook page, a YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. People just need to search Sound Bath Jax, right?
Sound Bath Jax, yes. And on the YouTube channel, there's 30 and 40-minute sound baths and even some shorter ones just to give you a little peace.
Diana, thank you for this, our little moment of zen today. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm here for you guys if you need.
So to get your sound bath, whether virtually or in person, because retail outlets are opening back up again next week, just go to facebook.com/soundbathjax. And stay calm, everybody. That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. The scintillating Heather Schatz produces this program. Josh Torres keeps the ship running. He's our show director. Jessica Palumbo runs news at 89.9 in the most fabulous fashion. And our intrepid and hardworking and collegial digital editor is the great Bill Bortsfield. And you are always a big part of what we do. Keep those emails, questions, and comments coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup. We'll have a closer look at the phased reopening of the state and also look at why so many Florida residents are being told they're ineligible to get unemployment insurance, even though they're tax-paying citizens who are out of work. That's coming up at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Stay calm out there. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.